You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toko ingoa, no mai haere mai ke te wire mō tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 16th of August. I'm your host Shimena, and with me in studio are my producers Ruben and Will.
What's up?
Hey guys, how are you doing today?
Swell.
Yeah, we're finally playing Ruben's very exciting Vape Nation story, which we've hyped up a lot previously on previous shows.
It deserves the hype, 100%.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So that is coming up first. He speaks with Professor of Population Health Chris Bullen and Whanganui Mayor Hamish McDowell. But other than that on the show today, we have Tracy Martin from New Zealand First, as always, joining us to talk about the government's new learning support pilot that has been extended to more than 70,000 children. On Dear Science today, we chat to AUT's Alan Blackman about the first telegraph message, alternative medicine and Indian cow urine. And producer Will Parsonson speaks to Auckland University lecturer Ronald Kramer about the polarising nature of graffiti. Get in touch with us on about any of the things that we cover today. 5395 is the number to text, and 5395 is the number to call.
We're about,
you know,
up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Over the past few years, you may have noticed people walking around expelling large clouds of vapour, and you may have wondered if they're pretending to be steam trains. Well, these people are in fact using electronic cigarettes. These electronic cigarettes, or vapes, vaporise a liquid that generally contains propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavouring and nicotine. Many people have switched from tobacco smoking to vaping, claiming that it is far healthier and cheaper. The vaping industry has seen dramatic international growth over the past few years, with forecasts suggesting the industry will grow to over $40 billion during the next 4 years. It is safe to say that vaping has taken off, with quite the subculture forming around it. There are vape bars, vape communities, and even vape festivals. Although there are many proponents of vaping, there are also those that are staunchly opposed, claiming that it not only causes cancer, but looks stupid. I spoke to Chris Bullen, a professor of population health at the University of Auckland, and asked him about the health implications of vaping.
What we know is about, we don't know what's going to happen to people who are vaping, say now, and who are vaping now and in 10 or 20 years' time, so we don't have that information yet. But what we do have is pretty good information around what's actually in vapour, and we can compare that with what's in cigarette smoke. And what we know is that vapour from e-cigarettes doesn't contain a whole lot of the stuff that's really harmful that's in cigarette smoke. So on that basis, and what there is that's similar to in cigarette smoke tends to be at much, much lower levels. So on that basis, we would say that e-cigarette use, if it's a direct substitution for smoking cigarettes, if you quit all your cigarettes and just vape, then it would be a really good thing for your health. It's not going to be completely safe as, say, quitting everything completely, but it would be a lot safer, probably 80 to 95% safer than continuing to smoke cigarettes.
Right, yeah, so there was this study out of the UK that indicated vaping was at least 95% safer than tobacco smoking. Did you accept the findings of that study?
Well, in part, that study was based around sort of expert advice based on the existing information they had available. What's happened since then is that more studies have been done looking at the various constituents and effects. I've just had one of my students look at this, and what we found was we compared all the products from all the research that's been done on e-cigarettes and looking at the same constituents in cigarette smoke, and looking at the levels and finding them to be significantly orders of magnitude lower, and also well below the thresholds used by international agencies like the EPA, the Environmental Protection Organization in the United States, to say when something's carcinogenic or it's going to be harmful to your heart. And so the levels of the constituents of e-cigarette vapor in the studies that have been done are much, much lower. So I think they're pretty much on the money, but it will vary on how people use these devices and, you know, how long for, and the quality of the e-liquid that they're using.
So our government is making moves to legalise vaping, but at the same time, recently the Whanganui City Council has limited vaping in public places, with the Mayor Hamish McDougall claiming that it increases the chance of oral cancers and acts as a gateway to cigarettes. Is there any substance to these claims?
No, there is no substance to those claims. So, you know, there is a lot of ignorance out there, if I may be so bold to call that ignorance. It's really fear or concern about on sort of moral basis rather than any scientific evidence. So the gateway is the idea that particularly young people, children, who don't smoke will use e-cigarettes, and that will become a sort of a great gateway for them to move on to tobacco cigarettes. But there's very, very limited evidence from any research suggesting that's happening. There was a recent study published in a pretty prestigious journal in the US, which purported to show a gateway effect. But what's actually happening with youth smoking in the US is that it's dropping dramatically, as it is here in New Zealand. So it doesn't line up with the overall population evidence. And the other piece of misinformation about oral cancer, there is no evidence that vaping causes oral cancer. Smoking and chewing tobacco is associated with oral cancer, but vaping is not the same as smoking. It doesn't involve combustion, it doesn't involve tobacco, and there is no evidence to support that statement.
Are there any secondhand vaping effects?
Yeah, that's the subject of quite a bit of scientific research, but the concentrations of harmful products that we find in cigarette smoke are just not there. The solution to pollution is dilution. So when you smoke outside, you know, the concentrations of harmful things tend to be much less than they are in an enclosed space such as a car. And the same applies to vaping. And because vaping produces so fewer toxic substances and in much lower levels than cigarette smoke, when you go outside, for example, then it's not such an issue. What does happen is that the sticky propylene glycol in the vaping cloud, the aerosol that's generated from any cigarette, it does adhere to surfaces, and if that has nicotine on it, then obviously some of those surfaces will have nicotine on them. But nicotine really isn't the harmful thing in smoking. It's all the other junk that goes along with it that kills people. Nicotine just makes people addicted to smoking. So I think going back to vaping in secondhand vaping, so-called, the risks to health, the evidence for that is not strong. Much, much lower than secondhand smoke. And I think it should be up, at the moment, I think it should be up to individual premises owners to determine what their rules are about those issues.
Do you think the benefits of vaping outweigh the costs to public health?
Really good question. I think the evidence is now starting to emerge that that is indeed the case. A recent study in the British Medical Journal suggested that vaping has increased quit or smoking cessation in the US by about 25%. And so that's a big win for public health if you're getting lots of people quitting smoking. And there's been some really good work looking at, you know, even if there was a little bit of gateway effect, and that is swamped by the numbers of people who are actually quitting smoking. So the net public health benefit, if, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are smokers transition completely across to e-cigarette, then the gains for public health are absolutely huge.
Last month, the Whanganui Council signed off on its new smoke-free policy that now restricts vaping in the CBD and public parks. This is partly in response to Regional Health Network figures that show over the past 3 years, smoking rates have increased by 2% in Whanganui. I spoke to Whanganui Mayor Hamish McDougall and asked him what he made of Professor Bullen's statements.
Our evidence was different. Obviously we'll be regularly reviewing the bylaw, but the policy. But we had a medical professional, a very experienced and well qualified doctor, speaking on behalf of a group, saying that there is evidence. So, obviously, with a conflict of evidence, you're going to have to test it. What I would say is we had no submissions in support of vaping. So you've got to realise the mechanism of a committee hearing submissions. We deal with what's in front of us. But we totally acknowledged that there is no evidence about vaping being a portal gateway. But then vaping's remarkably new. And so in some of these circumstances, you don't have a lot of evidence, and you've got to make an assessment about a new technology. I mean, look at synthetic cannabis. It was legal 4 years ago because it was a new thing that had come along, and now, of course, people are suffering terribly from it. Again, I come back to my to an earlier statement. As an educative thing, it's not a punitive policy. Apart from the health concerns that the committee heard, the significant thing is people walking around with plumes of smoke.
Do you think that's just surrounding the taboo aspect of smoke, though? Well, it's vapor. It's not smoke. It looks like smoke. Do you think it's more cultural rather than actually evidence-based?
Well, certainly our decision was evidence-based. Now, whether that evidence is as full or not, that's another discussion. Look, I'm staring down at one of the main streets of Wanganui right now, and I'm seeing three people smoking. Okay, so we've got a smoke-free policy in the CBD here. It's not evident that people are going, oh, right, smoke-free, I'll have to stub my cigarette out. So the idea is, over time, there'll be pressure on people giving up smoking. And there'll be pressure on people to reassess their recreational choices around vaping. I'm not going to ever be a supporter of vaping. A, I think it looks ridiculous. and B, I do think it normalises the idea of and it may be cultural, I don't care, but normalises the idea of something going into people's mouths.
Sure, but I mean, there are stories from countless people on the web that claim vaping has helped them quit smoking. And if evidence suggests that it is both a viable and safer alternative, don't you think vaping should be accepted with open arms? I mean, it could save people's lives if it's a lot safer than smoking.
I've always acknowledged that it is safer than smoking. Equally, I'm not going to be not going to say that it's not that's completely safe. I mean, to have seen with my own eyes one of my staff members vaping and then unable to talk for about 2 or 3 minutes successfully because she's had something hot in down her throat, and you think that cannot be. And we had medical evidence to back it up.
What evidence?
Fully healthy. Well, we had evidence from the doctor I mentioned, speaking on behalf, that it does actually cause oral cancers. Now, you've got evidence that says the other way. I don't know what to do with the conflict of evidence.
Well, you could look at the majority of it, and the majority of it does suggest that it does not cause cancer. I mean, there was an expert independent evidence review published by Public Health England, and they concluded that vaping is around 95% less harmful than smoking. And if it's used as a nicotine replacement therapy, then surely it should be accepted. If we're getting smokers onto vaping and vaping is healthier, then why not accept that?
I'm not saying it's not 95% a healthier option by any means. I'm saying what's the other 5%?
Sure, but if people are originally smoking, right, then you'd prefer them to be vaping, surely.
Absolutely, of course. I don't see how my position is different to yours. But I'll tell you something, you've got lots of people on the web saying how it's assisted them quitting smoking. I have lots of people saying, hey, it was a gateway for my kid. Now, there's no evidence about that. It's anecdotal on your behalf and my behalf. But the fact is that
there's also medical evidence that says it does help with getting off tobacco.
I've not seen medical evidence, so you're in a stronger position than me. I have not seen that, and it was not presented to us. What we had is a very experienced medical professional speaking on behalf of a group of physicians, saying there is evidence that it causes health issues. And you know, when you hear that, it's clear as a bell. Now you're presenting something that I haven't read. It might be well true. So when we review this policy, I'm sure the vaping industry and individuals who have benefited from it will present some of that evidence to us. But the fact is, we go on what's in front of us just the same as any court of law or any council in New Zealand has to do. We follow the evidence. The evidence is there. We ignored the stuff that's anecdotal, even though you know, you have to say that it's quite cynical when a vaping retailer is offering nicotine along with the liquid that's purchased. I don't think there's many answers to that.
Well, nicotine's not actually that bad for you, though. So I understand it's addictive, but there's no evidence that it causes cancer.
When you're being offered nicotine, and nicotine is more readily available into your bloodstream by smoking, then you've got to look at that passing over of that free bottle of liquid to someone who's purchased, well, I don't know, Cherry Ripe Vape or whatever it is.
Has that been confirmed, though? I mean, you were just talking about the validity of anecdotal evidence.
No, it's absolutely confirmed. It happened the morning of the hearing. The person went in there, it was a council staff member, went in there, purchased it, and was offered free nicotine.
You said it was because they gave it for free because it's illegal to sell it, right?
That's right.
So is that not a legislation issue? I mean, the government is making moves to legalise it.
Sure it is, but what I'm saying is, I agree, it's a legislative issue, but you've got to look at the cynicism of that retailer and think that's so cynical to offer an addictive substance that, in fact, is better deployed in a cigarette as part of a vaping sale. To me, there's no way around pretending that's anything but concerning.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was producer Ruben McLaren speaking with Professor Chris Bullen and Whanganui Mayor Hamish McDowell about vaping. Now, if you want to vote in our vaping poll about whether vaping should be banned from public spaces or not, please go online to our Twitter page, 95BFM News, and let us know your thoughts.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Hey Tracy, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Jamina. How are you? Glad to see you survive the thunderstorm on Sunday.
I know. It was great to meet you in person at the Auckland event on Sunday. If any listeners watch that or are keen to still watch that, that's on our Facebook page. We had a bit of really good chats with you as well as some other politicians. So, yeah, it was great to meet you in person.
Yeah.
So today I wanted to talk to you about how Education Minister Nikki Kay announced the other day that a learning support pilot will be extended to approximately cover 70,000 more children. So she says the pilot is in its current stages and has been successfully trialled in three Bay of Plenty communities of learning. Therefore, they're extending it to cover another 30 communities across the country. So nationally, they'll be putting 15 Ministry of Education senior staff as facilitators across the communities who will coordinate to provide help for those students who may need additional support for their learning. So is this the right approach to helping students who have learning difficulties?
There's a couple of things that are disappointing, I think, about this particular announcement. First of all, when I sat on the inquiry into dyslexia, dyspraxia and children with the autism on the autism spectrum and how they were being catered for inside our state school system. And what that inquiry told us was that the system is actually 100% broken. And it's probably even worse for children with more physical and intellectual disabilities on top of that. So, and the government's and the ministry's perspective always was, right from the beginning of that inquiry, that they would put in no more money and that they saw that the schools weren't using the current staff that they had effectively enough, efficiently enough. And so all what we've just had here is, regardless of the inquiry, the ministry has gone ahead by putting in 15 senior officials at God knows what salary they're on into communities of learning and only communities of learning to make them use their current staff, which we quite clearly showed was not adequate, to use their current staff more efficiently. So that's why the parents, the communities that are supportive of special needs children are really, really disappointed in this statement.
But have they not, I mean, they say, though, that they have consulted with communities, but before rolling out the pilots, they consulted communities about what changes were needed. So National said that they spoke to, or the government said that they spoke to 3,600 parents, families and whānau, as well as groups from disability and education sectors, to find out what was needed. So there was that consultation that did take place for this pilot, I suppose.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We once again come back to the word consultation. So to me, what the word consultation is that you ask a question and the people who are most seriously affected give you the answers. And that's what we had from the inquiry. We had a large number of submissions. This conversation, the review of special needs funding and support for our students, has been going on for over a decade. But what it appears that the government calls consultation is, this is what we're going to do. What do you think of it? And regardless of whether you think it's a good idea or not, we're going to roll it out. So it happened in Christchurch after the, you know, with regard to the amalgamations of schools, and we've got the Ombudsman report to show that that is what happened there. It's happened with regard to national standards. It's happened again and again and again with this government. So I'm sorry, just, you know, I'm a little cynical when the government says we consulted. I think what they mean is we told people what we were going to do, they told us they didn't like it, and we went ahead and did it anyway.
So have you heard, though, from people specifically involved in this trial of the pilot in the three Bay of Plenty communities of learning, who, I mean, the government says that they've received positive feedback, so have you heard otherwise from these people involved in this pilot?
Well, there's been no actual review of those pilots. So it's been trialled in three communities of learning, but there's been no actual physical review of whether it was successful or not.
So, but have you heard from them yourself about how it hasn't worked? Because they've heard feedback that it has worked.
No, because I don't know who those communities of learning are. And I mean, I'm not allowed to reach into schools without the minister of the permission of the Minister of Education. So, as an opposition MP, there's barriers because they're public servants. Teachers are public servants, and so are principals, and also they're independent bodies, but they're state funded. So I can't just walk onto any school ground or contact any school technically without the permission of the Minister of Education.
So what should they have done instead, though? They should have just kept this trial small and done it for longer, and then made a.
I think you're missing the point. We've got a whole inquiry that tells them what they need to do, and none of it was about putting 15 senior Ministry of Education staff members into communities of learning. Not a single one of the submissions or recommendations that came from the actual inquiry and the people who submitted on it was this model. This model was what the ministry had already decided before we held an inquiry.
I don't think it's
not relevant, actually. This is not the answer for the special needs community of our schools.
So let's talk about communities of learning then. So you're saying that is the fundamental problem here. Those should not exist because they're
No. What I'm saying is, because this is about special needs children. Let's be clear. This is not about communities of learning. This is about special needs children. What the government has done is connected that the support for special needs children to communities of learning. So they've taken two separate entities and muddled them up. The whole purpose of this is about how will we support inclusive education for those students who need it.
But the
and
government
the ministries decided it's going to be through communities of learning.
But the government believes that those communities of learning are providing these things to students who need that additional help. I mean, they're talking about the benefits of this approach, give flexible, faster services to support these children, that's child-centred, and also so parents and teachers have one person at the ministry who sort of knows what their child needs, that it's kind of this more personalised approach for these children, and also a more collaborative approach through these communities of learning. So what is the issue with these communities of learning that you have for these students with additional learning needs?
All of that is rhetoric. Every single one of those things that you just said again comes from a press release to try and make it sound like it's a brilliant idea.
But where's your counter evidence? So they've talked to these...
In the inquiry, Chimina, I could send you the inquiry. I could send you hundreds upon hundreds of letters. I could send you to the VIP's Facebook. I could send you to Education for All, that organisation. I could send you to hundreds of pieces of evidence from the families on the front line saying what they needed. And none of what they needed is what has just been provided.
And so what are they needing instead? Tell me what you think the government should be doing instead.
No, it's not what I think. It's what they told us. And what they told us in the inquiry, and there's something like 28 recommendations on the back of that inquiry that New Zealand First, the Green Party and the Labour Party have committed to provide to those families. And it's about support, more resourcing, and that's actual human resourcing, that's teacher aid resourcing, that's increasing to the AWS funding to 3% of the population, that's more speech language therapists, more SENCOs, more... Honestly, mate, this system is broken, and 15 high-level ministry officials inside of communities of learning is not the solution.
So finally, just before you have to head off, let's touch on a policy National announced in the weekend, which is their plan to send young offenders to a military camp. So what are your thoughts on this? Is this the right approach to help youth offenders?
Well, it's a knee-jerk approach, that's the first thing, because what we want to do is prevent serious youth offenders in the first instance, so that would be smarter. But I guess for me, the major concern I have about this announcement is, how are they going to keep those 50 very serious young offenders on the Wairuru base? Because there's no fencing, etc. The Wairuru base is not needed to be enclosed because everybody previously on there was a volunteer, right? And so are they going to build a youth prison at Wairuru? Is that what they're going to say and have the army run it? Or are these young people, if there's no fences to keep these incredibly serious offenders, even though they're young, inside any walls, how do the people of Wairuru themselves feel about that? It hasn't been thought through, I don't think. I think it's something they've thought up in the last 7 days.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us today, Tracy. We will talk to you again next week.
See you, Jamina. Bye.
Okay, bye.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
Flying out and 95BFM present the Others Way Festival, Friday, September 1st, all around K Road. The best of New Zealand is coming to K Road with Beck Runga, Lawrence Arabia, The Courtneys, Micronism, Sneaky Feelings, and heaps more. The Others Way 2017. Tickets from Flying Out and online at flyingout.co.nz and undertheradar.co.nz. Limited early bird tickets available. Thanks to Karma Cola, Coffee Supreme, Kate Sylvester, K Road Business Association, Going Global Music Summit, Garage Project, APRA AMCOS NZ, One Music, and Phantom Bill Stickers.
The hard, fast, and heavy show on 95BFM with the Whammy Crew every Sunday night from 11 p.m. till 1 a.m.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Kia ora, Alan. How are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you, Shamina.
Fantastic.
And last week we started off with a musical recommendation from me, if you recall. So if
yes,
you'll,
we
if,
did.
If you'll indulge me again.
Oh, go for it. What would you like to share with us today?
Well, Stephen Wilson's got a new album out this week.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Porcupine Tree, and... the recommendation is a song called The Raven Who Refused to Sing. And if you go to YouTube and look that up, and if you can watch that from go to woe without tearing up, then you're probably a better person than I am. It's an extraordinary song. So
we should,
and a wonderful video.
We should check it out, see if we've got in the system, see if we can play it later today. Anyway, the first story that you have for us today is about how Queen Victoria sent the first official transatlantic telegraph in 1858 to US President Buchanan. So tell me about this.
Absolutely. And that was today, in fact, in 1858, which is why we are talking about it today, I guess. So I guess it just shows how we can sort of contrast what we take for granted today with the very early days of communication. And as you rightly said, in 1858, Queen Victoria sent the US President James Buchanan a telegraph, and this was across the newly laid cable across the Atlantic Ocean. And... the telegraph itself was 99 words long, or 509 letters or characters, I guess, which is about 3.5 tweets these days. And basically it was sort of congratulating him upon the cable being finished, et cetera, all in very sort of florid language. The interesting thing about it was that they started transmitting this at 10:50 a.m. in the morning, and they finished transmitting this at 4:30 a.m. the next morning. So
wow, that is a long.
That's basically
long
2 minutes per letter. So you sort of think of the people that they're you know, waiting in the States for each sort of individual letter, guessing what the next letter is going to be, presumably.
Oh my god,
fun even.
The suspense.
I know. And so this was obviously sent by Morse code, which was developed sort of about 10 years earlier by Samuel Morse. The first commercial telegraph was 1838, and the first telegraph itself was about 1816, the first demonstration of a telegraph, which seemed to me quite early. I was quite surprised by that date of 1816. But, you know, contrast that now with the fact that a certain yellow-haired, short-fingered vulgarian can get his views out to the rest of the world essentially instantaneously. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing these days, but it is a thing.
Yeah, it is faster and, you know, better access, always a good thing, you know?
And the really sad thing about the whole original transatlantic cable was that 3 weeks after Queen Victoria sent that message and was replied to by James Buchanan, the signals were getting a bit weak or something, so some guy at the end of it turned the voltage up and fried the whole thing. So it lasted a whole 3 weeks, laying a transatlantic cable, and it was gone after 3 weeks.
Which, so they laid this cable one specific thing, or
they'd sent some messages on it beforehand just to test it out and everything, but this was the first official use of the cable, and it was going to be used for transatlantic communication, but 3 weeks later, blah. So then they went and just did another one, etc., etc. But boy, what an expense for 3 weeks worth of telegraphs at 2 minutes per letter.
I'm blown away that they even had the technology to lay a cable like that. I mean, this is, we're talking the time when sailing ships were still the main form of transport. So they,
yeah, I think these were steamships that laid it, I think, but don't quote me. My nautical expertise is a bit thin, but but it is, yeah, and you're right, it's extraordinary for the time, and just how far we've come is amazing too.
So what would the cable be made of?
Well, apparently, it used a thing called gutta percha, which is a type of rubber, and so the whole thing had to sort of come together at the right time, because they didn't have those sort of polymeric materials that we've got now, and so they had to use this natural rubber, and so therefore that came from Malaya or whatever, all the plantations out there. So, and you know, it was around about that time that they were starting using this sort of thing, so that waterproofed the whole thing. So you know, it was a combination of technologies, I guess, because you know, you had your electricity, obviously, you had the Morse code, you had the waterproofing, etc., etc., etc. So just that's the way that science works. You know, things just come together at the one time, and it takes, you know, one person to see the possibilities of putting all these things together. So, you know, that's obviously what happened then.
Fascinating. That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty cool.
And so moving on to a slightly darker subject, I suppose. So we've got new research that shows cancer patients who turn to alternative medicine are 2.5 times more likely to die. So tell me about this study.
Okay, so this was published, I think, last week in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute by some workers at Yale University, so a very prestigious university in the States. And as you correctly say, the key finding of the study was that people who turn to solely alternative medicine were 2.5 times more likely to die than those who were treated with what we would call, or what people call sadly, conventional medicine, what I just call medicine. So the way that it worked, the study involved 281 patients who, when they had a diagnosis of cancer, relied solely on alternative medicine. Okay. And these were then compared with 560 patients who chose the more conventional route. So the cancers that were of interest were breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. So the four sort of biggest killing cancers in the States. And the alternative medicine people chose whatever alternative medicines they had, and the conventional medicines. So they were treated using chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, hormone therapy, those sorts of things. So your conventional treatments. And in all cases, for each type of cancer, you were at least 2.5 times more likely to die if you just use the alternative rather than the conventional, with the big one being breast cancer, which was 5 times more likely. So if you refuse conventional treatment with breast cancer, you're 5 times more likely to die. Really interestingly, they studied the makeup of the alternative medicine group, and they found that they were more likely to be younger, female, interestingly higher income and education, and also have breast cancer. So those were basically the people who were undergoing the alternative, which, yeah, I found that quite surprising, particularly the higher income and education sort of thing. But, yeah. Well, each their own, I guess. And finally, they're looking at the five-year survival rates for people who were diagnosed with cancer. And with the alternative medicine, the five-year survival rate was about 55%. And with the conventional, it was about 78%. And again, breast cancer was a particular standout there. It was 58% using alternative versus 87% using conventional methods. So now you look at the comments on this, and there's a depressingly large number of people who are just saying, oh, this is all big pharma. The study was funded. Well, it's published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, so they're obviously employed by the National Cancer Institute. No, they're not. They're employed by Yale University. The study was obviously funded by Big Pharma because, you know, chemotherapy is just developed to make you dependent on the stuff that doesn't work. And yeah, it really is sad. I don't know where people get these ideas from. There's an enormous amount of time and energy that goes into developing drugs. Obviously, okay, we want to create drugs that make people well, that cure these horrible diseases. Shit, you know, we want to get rid of cancer. It would be fantastic if we could. And the reason that you make any advances at all in that respect is because of people beavering away in the laboratories and doing these studies. Now, when you are trying to come up with a cancer drug, you've got to go through FDA approval, Federal Drug Administration in the States. And that process is extraordinarily long, extraordinarily torturous. There's three stages to it. If you get through all three stages, then you can then license your drug for use. You get patent protection on that for X number of years. I think it's seven, I can't remember. But to get to stage three, you have invested a hell of a lot of money in doing this. Okay, so it would be great if it was totally altruistic, but you know, people have got to make money. They've got to cover their costs somewhere along the line. So, you know, that's why you end up having to pay for drugs. And some drugs are ridiculously expensive just because of their sheer nature, okay? Some drugs are very, very simple to make, very cheap to make. And some drugs, like, you know, something like aspirin, that's very easy. You can make that in a first-year laboratory. But, you know, the drugs that are coming out today, they're sort of biologically derived drugs. They're extraordinarily expensive things. And, you know, that's why the treatment costs are so high. And that's why, thank goodness, we've got a thing called Pharmac, which, you know, I guess shields New Zealanders to a certain extent from those high prices, probably at the expense of not funding particular horribly expensive drugs where cheaper ones will be just as efficacious, potentially anyway. Okay, so but I mean, that's getting away from the point a little bit. The point is that don't rely on alternative medicine, so-called alternative medicine, you know. In my view, there's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine and that's it, you know. So
we talked a little bit about this on the breakfast show this morning.
Yeah.
And producer Sarah, she raised a point in that. So we have a naturopath who comes to visit us every Monday morning on the breakfast show, who tries to, you know, she's not saying this is an alternative to the established medical treatment, that it is complementary.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Now, that's, yeah, and that's probably what the way that they're trying to save themselves, that they talk about complementary medicine, which is in concert with the sort of your chemotherapy and stuff like that. And, you know, of course, if you're undergoing chemotherapy and stuff, it's a good idea to eat well, you know. It's a good idea to look after yourself. That's just sort of common sense. And these so-called complementary approaches, you know, who's to say that they're giving any better outcomes than what would have happened in their absence? So,
right, yeah, because if you're taking them together, then
you don't really know what would happen. Of course, that, ladies and gentlemen, is the trouble with medical research, is that you cannot do the control experiment. You can never look at what would have happened in the absence of that particular treatment. You're dealing with a single person, you're giving them a drug, and they either get better or they die. You have no idea what would have happened in the absence of that drug. You can't do the control experiment. And that's why medical research is so fraught and so controversial, I guess, which is why studies like these are done. And as soon as they are put out, then you get an enormous amount of feedback. I'm sure people are, you know, tweeting or whatever about this right now. But that is the sad fact of the matter.
Mm. I mean, sorry, just one of the arguments I've heard from these alternative medicine people is that back in the Middle Ages, people used urine and things, and they thought that was the correct medicine, mm-hmm. you know, in yep. terms of treating like Black Plague and things like that.
Yep.
And they argue that what's the difference between then and now and us using, say, chemotherapy? They could say that in the future they might look back at us and think what we're doing is archaic. But I would almost argue that we experiment with alternative medicine, or we experiment with all these random things like drinking urine or whatever you mm-hmm. want to do in your spare time.
Yeah.
And we take what works from those medicines and turn that into actual medicine.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I completely agree. I mean, you know, a lot of drugs are derived from plant material. So, you know, you for example, aspirin. So that comes from willow bark originally. And that was an ancient treatment. People would boil up willow bark when they had, you know, the flu or whatever, any sort of inflammatory sort of things. And that would cure that. And eventually they found out that this thing, salicylic acid, was present in willow bark, and that's essentially what aspirin is. So, you know, I'm not saying there's nothing out there in nature yeah. that can't be used. You know, that's just not the case. But, I mean, there was a guy in the Herald on Saturday, I think, who is treating cancer patients with leeches and claiming that... you know, he's getting great results and people are being cured of cancer, and he says he can't do the clinical trials of these because it costs too much, or some, you know, some nonsense like that. Hell, if you've got a cure for cancer, man, then, you know, you should be getting out there and telling the world and giving us proof.
Mm.
Because, yeah. you know, it's one of the most important things. If you could cure cancer, you know, you would be a fantastic person, you know. You would go down in history.
Mm. And something else that Mikey raised when we were talking about it this morning on the show was about how, I mean, and I think this is also a really important distinction that is made, and where some of the dislike or scepticism around, you know, the establishment of medical research and people being attracted to alternative medicine mm-hmm. is this idea of big pharma, and that bad science happens, therefore be suspicious of all sort of expensive drugs that are created in labs, because there is a lot of money around medicine, and, you know, we do know that bad science does happen, that things get published in dodgy journals and so on,
yes,
and so forth.
I agree.
But it's important to distinguish that from all of the...
Yes, no, absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that the FDA process is so torturous means that no bad science is going to get... Well, I say no, and then immediately think of thalidomide. But then, of course, you know about thalidomide. No, no.
Tell us.
So that was a drug that was used as a morning sickness prevention drug in the early 60s. And they found out too late that it led to, in fact, a horrible birth defect. So kids were being born without limbs. And it was just horrific. And it was all down to the fact that the actual molecule could exist as mirror images, like hands. And one of the mirror images was a good molecule, and it would cure morning sickness. The other one led to the birth defects, and they didn't know this at the time. So yes, some things do get through, but for goodness, you know, and there's always side effects to drugs as well. There always are. You know, you look on any drug label, there's side effects may include blah 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 blah, but the process that it's got to go through means that it's so extraordinarily unlikely that just straight crap science is going to get through this process. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, know? I guess like these instances of where the process, where the very rigorous process has not worked,
yep.
are very much, you know, they shouldn't be used to like be extrapolated to, therefore
exactly
for people to see the whole of medical research that does exist, or all research for that, all scientific research for that matter, that
yeah.
it's not, oh, well, this is therefore evidence that the whole system is fucked.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I couldn't have put that better myself. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I assume chemotherapy, don't you mean mustard gas, is a text from a listener. Don't know what that means, but...
Yeah, well, chemotherapy necessarily involves interactions with our DNA. You
mm-hmm.
know, that's what it's all about. And the trick with chemotherapy is to specifically target cancerous DNA. So you're looking at specifically targeting cancerous cells. Now, we can't do that absolutely yet. When we can, cancer will be gone. If you can specifically target a cancerous cell, then we've got the chemicals that can kill that, okay? Now, the body is brilliant at recognizing, cells, but we're not quite so good at that yet. We can't yet quite, make the molecules that are going to do that. But we're making, big advances in that region, so...
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that's also the thing as well. It's that it's not that the current established medical treatments for cancer that doctors or scientists are saying these work and these are the most robust ways of treating cancer because, there's so many cases in which they don't work and that people are dying.
Yes, yep.
But that this is the thing that is proven to help more people than anything else.
Indeed, and you'll never get a doctor saying this will cure you of cancer. That, because you can't say that with certainty. But what you can say with certainty is it will increase your chances of surviving.
Mm. And so just very quickly, we'll touch on our last our last topic for today. So a mysterious pigment has often been used to spot fake art. Tell me about this.
Yeah, indeed. This is a really interesting story, actually. So if you want to spot a fake painting, how do you go about spotting the fake painting? So one way is to do an analysis of the pigments, because if you're looking at some painting by Leonardo da Vinci or somewhere like that from the 15th 16th century, then they would use particular pigments at that stage, which were only around at that particular time. Is it a fake? Is it a forgery? Then if it is, that it would have been painted in the 20th century and they would have used different stuff. So you've got to analyze somehow the pigments in the painting to see whether it's a real thing or not. And you need, therefore, a non-destructive method of being able to do that. Okay? You don't want to pick bits of... Well, you can pick little bits of paint, little flecks of paint off the painting, but ideally you don't want to touch it. You don't want to touch it. So there's a method called Raman spectroscopy. And this involves looking at the vibrations in a molecule, okay? It's very, very detailed. We're not going to go into it, but as simple as that, what you'd basically do is you shine light on it, and from the way that the light interacts, you can figure out what the molecules in the pigment are, basically. And in order to do that, you need some kind of standard, okay? So that's the important thing, is the standard, the whole standard. So if you know what a particular pigment looks like, the signature of a particular pigment when you shine light on it, then you can say, if you look at another sample of it and you get that same signature, then you can say with certainty that that pigment's present in the other painting. Okay? So there's this thing called Indian yellow, which is a painting that was a pigment that was much beloved by J.M.W. Turner, that famous English sort of landscape painter. Sort of a bright yellow colour, and it was called Indian yellow because apparently it came from the dried urine of Indian cows that had only been fed mango leaves. So they say, anyway. but it was a particular, or it consists of a particular molecule called eusanthic acid, and it was much beloved of Turner and sort of those of his ilk around about that time, but it was first discovered in the 14th century. Now, in the 19th century, they started making artificial dyes. And these natural, so-called natural ones from the cow urine and everything, obviously horribly expensive because, there's not too many, Indian cows that get fed only on mango leaves. But William Perkin came along and started making artificial dyes, which were way cheaper. And so he made a yellow colour called tartrazine, which is in food colouring and stuff like that. Now, the two colours, the tartrazine and the Indian yellow, the two molecules are very, very different molecules. And by shining light on them, and looking at their signatures, you can figure out which one's which, okay? So what they've just discovered is that they mixed it up way back when. So the stuff that they thought was authentic Indian yellow was, in fact, the tartrazine. And so the standard that they'd used for Indian yellow for all of these years was, in fact, the standard for tartrazine. And so they've got it horribly, horribly wrong. So all of the paintings that have been tested using this technique,
right,
which were said to be, they must be real.
This is authentic because of these things.
Now it looks really like they're not.
So do they have to go around to museums all over the world and do these tests just to make sure that they don't have a fraudulent painting hung up on in the space of the actual legit thing?
Exactly. And so there's at least three works of art that they've discovered that very probably are now forgeries.
Really?
Where they thought that they were kosher. So I think watch the space. I think it's a fascinating paper, this, and it really has got sort of quite enormous ramifications for the art world. So,
so interesting.
There goes chemistry for you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Chemistry can be fun. Cool. Well, thanks for joining us again this week, Alan.
Not a problem, Shemina.
That was Dear Science. Marlon Williams is coming for you this November, now playing two shows at the Point Chevalier RSA. Due to popular demand, there's now a second date at the same intimate venue. Get in quick.
I'm a vampire again, and I'm coming for you.
Marlon Williams, live at the Point Chevalier RSA, Friday, November 10th, sold out. Thursday, November 9th, now available. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Yeah, hi, this is Kane...
Dude, use a fake name!
Oh, right, shit, this is, Shane.
What do you want to hear?
Could you play a Kane in the Karate Chop song, please?
Yeah. Which one?
Any. Any is fine.
Sure thing.
Nice one, Kane.
Yeah, now we just sit back and wait for the APRA checks to start rolling in.
God, you're a genius, Kane.
The Jukebox Parlor Request Show, every Saturday night from 7 to 9, and join Song and her fabulous guests playing all the songs you want to hear.
This radio station was named Kowalski, in honor of the last American hero to whom speed means freedom of the soul. The question is not when he's going to stop, but who is going to stop him.
We'll be right back.
Kowalski. Bill Kowalski.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that's the end of another Wednesday show. We're just going to do a couple of fun facts before we head off today. So my fact is about how bananas, as we currently know them, you know, the Cavendish banana, they're actually a human invention because bananas, wild bananas, grow with big black seeds. Mm. So the bananas that we know, because people are picky and don't want to have huge black seeds in their bananas, a banana hybrid was created with teeny little seeds.
They increase the banana meat per se.
Mm. Well, exactly.
Which is the seed mass.
So those tiny seeds have no actual purpose. It's just because this was the product of a banana hybrid that was created for picky eaters.
That's like bananas.
They can't be
That's
used.
That's bananas.
So those little seeds are
Yeah, they're crap. Just, they don't serve any function in reproducing bananas.
Ooh.
True story.
Damn.
What about you, Will?
There is a desk in the US Senate operated by whichever senator sits there that is traditionally stocked with candy of that senator's choice to give out to other senators. So I'm thinking to myself, what does Donald Trump like to eat?
What's his
Sadness
candy of
and
choice? And what about you, Ruben?
All right, well, a Swiss couple in the Maldives paid £820 to have their wedding vows renewed in their native, I'm going to butcher this, Divihi language. When the wedding video was posted to YouTube, the subtitles revealed that the minister had actually been insulting them, calling them infidels and their children bastard swine.
Oh my God. You have the weirdest facts sometimes. Anyway, guys, I was like, oh my God, fruit facts, insect facts. So then you guys just whip these random stories out. Anyway, we're going into Sam's show. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us for the pieces that we played today. Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman, Chris Brillen, and Hamish McDowell. Thank you to everybody who tuned in, and big thanks to my producers, Will and Ruben, even though you got weird facts sometimes. We'll be back again next Wednesday.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.